The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
The Adventures of Captain Proton, Chapter 18, Bride of Chaotica. The evil Dr. Chaotica kidnaps Constance Goodheart and plans to sacrifice her to Arachnia, Queen of the Spider People. Captain Proton travels millions of miles to Planet X, where he will invade the Fortress of Doom. Chaotica fires his fiendish death ray. Certain death for Proton as his rocket ship bursts into flames.
We didn't burst into flames in the last chapter. Why are these recaps always so inaccurate?
Well, they brought people back to the theaters.
Cliffhangers.
The lost art of hyperbole. You ready?
Aye, Captain.
Let's get this show on the road.
Hello, everyone. It is Thursday, November 16th, 2023. I'm Robert Vaughn.
And I'm Paul McKeever.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Regular listeners of the show may have noticed that for the past couple of weeks, we have not produced a new show and have repeated our last program on shortwave. This is because our usual host, Bob Metz, had a bit of an accident. On October 27th, Bob slipped and fell and broke the top of his femur at the hip. It was a bit of a nasty fall, and he's been in hospital since then. He's undergone surgery and is on the mend, so he expects to make a complete recovery and will return to creating more excellent episodes of Just Right as soon as he's feeling better. This week, Paul McKeever, who has joined us both as guest and co-host in the past, we've decided to do an episode of our own in Bob's absence. And if you could not tell from our opening clip that was from Star Trek Voyager, today's episode revolves around the concept of evil. But before we talk about evil, let's remind you that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on shortwave from WBCQ The Planet, which broadcasts from Monticello, Maine, and on Channel 292, which broadcasts in Europe from Ingolstadt, Germany. You can follow us on your favorite podcast platform, and you can visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archived broadcast, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, many fans may remember my co-host today, Paul, as being the leader of the Freedom Party of Ontario, but he's also an author who has just completed a book on philosophy. So, Paul, I wonder if you could just give us a brief synopsis, if you will, of your book and when we might expect to see it available for purchase.
Sure, Robert, and thanks for having me on the program. You know, this book, I think you could see, this book is actually not a book about philosophy per se, but about philosophizing. So what I've done is I've provided the reader with a new way of thinking about long-standing philosophical problems. So there are essentially 12 long-standing philosophical problems. And I'll give you an example: free will versus determinism, the is-ought problem, the problem of universals. These are all big classic problems in philosophy that are regarded as being unresolved. And so I've, over the course of the last 9 years or so, gotten pretty comfortable with this method of thinking about these problems that I think resolves each of those 12 problems. So you will go through a 13-chapter book. The first chapter will tell you what that method is, and the remaining 12 chapters will be one problem at a time, and then a summarization, or a summary rather, at the end. That'll bring it all together and show how using this method can be used for lots of problems that I haven't even addressed in the book. And I'm really looking forward to see how people apply the method to other problems.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I look forward to its release, which I hope is soon, is it?
Well, the book is written. The audio has been recorded. The editing's being done, and just the final touches on, you know, corrections here and there for the text. And then it's just a matter of uploading it to Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you'll be able to get hard copies from Barnes & Noble also from Amazon. The hardcover comes from Barnes & Noble. And then Audible will carry the audiobook.
Oh, looking forward to it. Let's get a little serious here then, Paul, because over the last few weeks, we've seen some pretty nasty stuff dealing with our topic of evil. The events of October 7th, when over 1,000 terrorists belonging to Hamas stormed the Israeli communities near the border with Gaza and committed heinous atrocities against Israeli citizens, men, women, and children. And it should give everyone pause to think about just how low man as a species can stoop. Their actions were pure evil. But what is evil? To these murderers, they were committing acts of heroism and martyrdom in the name of their religion. They did not consider what they were doing to be evil. Instead, what they were doing, they thought, was the good. They were trained from birth, many of them, right, to do what they did on October 7th, to kill Jews, to cleanse Palestine of Jews, to instill terror, all in the name of their faith. But before we get into any sort of judgmental discussion, maybe on Hamas as a specific, why don't we define our terms? Let's talk about the key terms involved in this discussion would be evil, good, morality, and altruism. So asking you as a person who has over the last few years, especially in the development of your book, considered all of these terms very specifically, how would you define those terms?
Well, let's start with morality. So all of knowledge can be divided into two parts, facts and values, or what is and what you ought to do about it. Okay, so the ought part, that's the morality. The fact part, that's just the facts. You know, John crossed the road. Okay, what ought we to do about it? That's a question of morality. And so the morality always concerns values. What's better than this? What's worse than this? What should we do? What ought we not to do? That's morality. And the codes of morality that we find commonly often come from religion, but not always. For example, Ayn Rand had a philosophy which said that good and evil come from the nature of man. That which is, you know, pro the survival of an individual is good. That which is self-destructive is bad, basically. And the things you do, you should do in a way that will encourage your survival and not in a way that will ultimately lead you to misery and death. So, for example, work for your money, don't steal it, because stealing it ultimately will lead to guilt and probably imprisonment, whereas earning will lead to a feeling of pride that you've accomplished something and to your long-term survival.
You know, to that point, Paul, you and I have had discussions on this way back in the past, but many people think that moral action is simply action that is done to or for other people. Mm-hmm. While that kind of a definition, which I would agree with, of course, means that you can act morally or immorally if you're by yourself or if it doesn't directly affect anybody else. So let's say that you're on a deserted island and for your survival you have to find shelter and food and water and a means of rescue. And if you do not do those things and act that way, then you're being immoral.
That's right.
Would you think that's right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For example, if you just were to sit on the beach and wait for a boat to come in and provide you with all of those things, when there's absolutely no reason to believe a boat's ever going to see this island, I mean, it's a deserted island for a reason, then you're going to die. So the pro-death approach is to do nothing and wait for things to come to you as a gift or to steal it from others, which there's no one else on the island, so that's not going to work. The pro-life or the pro-survival approach is to go digging that well, pull those fruits off the trees, hunt those animals, whatever you have to do to survive, which takes effort and thought.
Right, and this brings up something that's been going through the internet recently when we hear people like, say, the Dave Rubens or the Dennis Prager type of people, conservatives usually, talk about the fact that atheists aren't moral, they can't act morally, they have no moral ethic, they have no frame of action. When, of course, if you use your definition, which I would agree with, Ayn Rand's definition, then, of course, anybody can be moral. If you get out of bed, I think Ayn Rand said, if you get out of bed, you have a philosophy. You have a framework for acting. So how do you respond to conservatives generally who say that atheists, or at least people who are not religious, because I'm not too fond of the word atheist because it's a reactionary word to their belief rather than the natural state of our own actions.
I agree.
People who don't necessarily believe in their God, right? Yeah. How do you respond to that kind of a criticism about morality and atheists?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the idea that they want a lawgiver, right? I think that's what is really behind it. If they think if the rules for life come from within, come from yourself, they can't possibly be anything but subjective, and therefore you're always going to bend the rules, change the goalposts, etc. Whereas if somebody else out external to you, a god, some tablets, what have you, say these are the rules, live by them, well then that had nothing to do with you. So obedience will be the highest good because this is obviously the way, the straight path. So I can understand people want that kind of unyielding set of rules or the unyielding framework so that they can't cheat, right? So that they can have a sense of being on the right side of things. But that was what was so wonderful about what Ayn Rand came up with. She said, well, the nature of man is unchanging, unyielding, right? There is no different kind of man. There's things that are common to all humanity that require us to do what we have to do to survive. In other words, there's not a human being on earth who can, by himself, survive without acting so as to collect food, collect water, etc. That's just an unyielding rule. It's think and act or die. And that's hard for some people to appreciate because I think at the same time they'll say, yeah, but how are you going to apply that? It sounds pretty subjective. And, it isn't. But often it's jarring, because when you get your rules from, two tablets that say thou shalt not lie, let's say, okay, well, what if you have Jews living in your basement and the Nazis are knocking on the door saying, do you have Jews in your house? Kantians, classic Christians would say, well, yeah, you're supposed to never lie. So I guess, let the chips fall where they may. I'm telling the truth. Well, the chips are in the basement and they're about to get murdered by a Nazi. So, there's something wrong with that. It's a bit of a crude approach. It has going for it the idea that it's unyielding. It comes from without. In that sense, it's unyielding. But I don't like using the phrase, but it's a simplified version of guiding one's life. Just
as a matter of fact, I sympathize as well. Because what conservatives or religious people who espouse a certain morality, usually their morality is altruism.
Yes.
At least what they have is a framework. They have a concept of right and what is wrong.
Right.
And they act accordingly and somewhat predictably, unless they are being untrue to themselves and their philosophy. As opposed to, for example, an anarchist, a libertine, a libertarian, a person who says that I'm the person who makes up all the rules, damn the rest of you, I'll do whatever I like without the consequences that you impose upon me being my fault. It's and there's so many of those people out there right now. If you just go on Twitter or X, you see it.
You're right. And unfortunately, I think that is actually the end result of altruism. Maybe we should define altruism. So altruism is just a French way of saying otherism. And it really, most people's understanding of otherism or altruism is the example of, say, Jesus, because, that's Christianity, Islam, all of that came through from that sort of Jesus, whether you see him as a prophet or son of God or what have you. The idea that, you should do unto others that which you would expect them to do unto you. So don't be a hypocrite. Be consistent across the board, and etc. And it sounds very good. The ultimate good in that system, of course, is sacrificing of yourself for others. Sacrificing of yourself. Not just helping others. Not just giving things that you don't really need, but literally giving till it hurts. In fact, giving till you die, in the case of Jesus, the ultimate example, right? Which is why people wear, a lot of them, wear a crucifix around their neck, like Catholics do, to say this is the ultimate example. This is what I hold to be the best, the ultimate good, right? To literally die for, my neighbor. And We just passed November 11th, which in Canada is Remembrance Day. Many times, I'm not a proponent of this idea, but many times the speeches we hear are about the sacrifices that were made and that we should honor people for making sacrifices. That's nobody signed up to make a sacrifice. They signed up to kill the bad guy. They were sacrificed, but that's not why they went. No one said, hey, I want to get chewed up in the wood chipper. Everyone said, I'm going to take the other guy and put him in the wood chipper. And we regret having lost so many people. We miss these people. We honor the fact that they did it for us. And they were sacrificed. We try to make some sense out of that by making the sacrifice itself good. But it wasn't the sacrifice that made us honor those people. It was the fighting spirit that they weren't willing to.
It's like General Patton said, you don't fight for your country. You don't die for your country. You make the other guy die for his.
Right. And if you think about that, if that's the ultimate good, dying for someone, right? Well, no one does it, right? Not even the soldiers do that. They go to fight, not to die. So we don't really value death. At least most of us don't. What we value is the kindness that we see in do unto others and that kind of thing. But the problem with altruism is when you're putting others first in every value, you always are sacrificing of yourself if you're doing it properly. And so it's not something that people do with any integrity. They can't consistently do that. People do want to get ahead in life. They want to buy a house. They want to be happy and have kids. They want to have their kids do better than maybe other kids, you know? So they give all kinds of money and education and everything to these children, but not to their neighbor's kids, which would have been the altruist thing to do, right? Sacrifice your own kids' welfare so that your neighbor's kids can do well. So we don't really practice altruism. We honor it in name, but we don't practice it. And the result is a constant feeling of not quite measuring up, lacking integrity, guilt, shame,
inadequacy, and frustration.
Right. And so what happens when you are faced with a constant day-to-day feeling of guilt and shame and inadequacy and there's no pride there, right? What would you be proud of? You aren't living by your own code. So at that point, you say to yourself, but wait a minute, nobody does. So who am I to feel guilty? Who am I to judge anyone? Who are they to judge me? Right? Why should I feel guilty? Maybe integrity is not all it's meant to be. Oh, you think you're so, you know, principled, you're always doing the right thing. You're no saint. You've done some sinning. Everyone's done some evil. So I don't have to worry about my failures. Or pride, that's the last thing you should value, right? What you should have is humility, because we're all sinners. No one is above the other.
As a matter of fact, pride is a sin.
Yes. Yeah. Because pride would suggest you're succeeding at something like, oh, I don't know, living a moral life.
Okay, let's take a little break. And during this break, we're going to hear from the Daredevil and Punisher, a fictional character who talks about these issues and who has no problem in dealing with evil in a very final way. And coming out of that after the bumper, we'll listen to Dave Rubin talk about a concept that I hope we can get into at length in this hour discussion, and that is that, is evil a mental illness? We'll be back right after this.
You're not a bad guy, right?
You want to explain that to the orphans and the widows of the men you killed?
Shit, that's what you think. I'm just some crazy asshole going around unloading on whoever I want to,
yeah,
huh?
That's exactly what I think.
That is.
You think you're anything else?
I think that the people I kill need killing. That's what I think.
You left men hanging from meat hooks.
They got off easy, in my opinion.
You shut up a hospital.
Yeah, nobody got hurt or didn't deserve it.
Yeah. What? You run around this city like it's your damn shooting gallery.
Yeah, what do you do? What do you do? You act like it's a playground. You beat up the bullies with your fists. You throw them in jail, everybody calls you a hero, right? And then a month, a week, a day later, they're back on the streets doing the same goddamn thing.
So you just put them in the morgue.
You goddamn right I do.
Steven Crowder has somehow got this manifesto, and He released it. So here is a tweet from Crowder, and we'll see if we make it through YouTube today. Breaking, Nashville school covenant shooter Audrey Hale's death day manifesto targeted crackers with white privileges. Want to kill all you little crackers. These are quotes, obviously, from the manifesto. I hope I have a high death count. I'm ready. I hope my victims aren't ready to die. Elon Musk responded to this, and he wrote this, clearly mentally ill, but also clearly brainwashed into being a mass murderer by the system. Now, I think it's worth discussing that point for a second, because anyone who commits any of these murders is mentally ill by definition. You guys remember that Uvalde shooting in Texas, the school where I think 18 kids and three teachers were shot. Cold blood murder, absolutely horrible. That was about 6 or 8 months ago. And we played that clip of Joy Reid the next day on her show saying that the shooter was not mentally ill. This was about the guns. And that is what a mentally ill person would say. The very definition of taking a gun and shooting innocent people, children who you don't know, all of that, that is by definition, you are mentally ill.
You know, I respect Dave Rubin immensely. I think, however, in this respect, he is doing a disservice to the cause of trying to understand why people do the things they do and how to respond to the things. Because if you say that evil is a result of mental illness, what you're doing is you're giving him a pass. And no, in law, and Paul, you're a lawyer, although not a criminal lawyer, you're a lawyer all the same, you've gone past the bar, so you know of what I speak when I say that in law, if you are found guilty or not guilty by reason of insanity, the penalty or the response from society is different
right.
than if you were willful and volitional in your actions. So what do you think about what Dave Rubin is saying here about evil being a mental illness by definition?
Yeah, that is absolutely wrong, but also absolutely predictable. We were just talking about, you know, altruism, the impossible moral code, the one that makes you feel guilty and inadequate and etc. What if a person is following a moral code quite well? I'm not saying moral in the sense of good. I mean, just they have a code of right and wrong, whatever that code is. Even Hitler had one, right? Wasn't the same as what most other people might have, but it was a code. So let's say that whether it's this shooter that we're talking about in the Rubin clip or the terrorists in Israel, what have you, attacking Israel, the tendency is to say, wait a minute, and this is going to be particularly, I mean, the first step will always be to say, that person's wrong because they didn't understand the facts. You see, you would have had the right view on the Palestine-Israeli situation if you only knew the facts. See, we have the same moral code. Everyone has the same moral code. We all believe in doing unto others and et cetera, don't we? And then, but what you don't understand is, dot, dot, dot. Read a book. You know, there's always that comment. No one wants to think that the people around them might have a moral code different from their own. You know, if you're a conservative, you either have the, you know, the God-given moral code or you have no moral code. It's impossible to begin. We were just talking about this. So they don't even recognize the existence of another kind of ethical code. So that's the first step, assuming, you know, that the only reason this person isn't doing the right thing is because they don't understand the facts. Well, what if it becomes blatantly obvious that they have the exact same understanding of the facts? Oh my goodness, they actually knew the facts, the same facts as me, and yet they did this thing that I would never do. Oh, well, they have to be crazy. Right? Because otherwise, they would have done what I would do in that situation. And I would never go in and shoot a school up. So that person, who is an altruist just like me, must have been crazy.
Or insane, exactly.
Yeah.
Or mentally ill.
Mentally
ill. Use whatever terms you like. In other words, it cannot be volitional. It cannot. He couldn't have done that willfully. He had to do it either out of ignorance or he's functionally insane.
Right. But what if the reality is that the person is just acting with greater integrity, acting out the exact same moral code that the denier, the person who doesn't want to believe they would ever do it, that they have. What are the exact same moral code? But the person who has that moral code says, I can't believe where this person took it. So for example, let's talk about Hitler, for example. That guy was a thoroughgoing altruist, collectivist. He didn't believe in the individual, he believed in the collective, the greater good, right? The greater good for Germans. Well, some Germans, for the Aryans, I think he called them. Okay, so that's his collective. That's his group that he's decided. That's his in-group and everyone else is an out-group. And he's decided that for the greater good, you know, for the other, it's necessary that we have Lebensraum, we have living space for our people. And so we have to make sure that we beat back the people who might otherwise take our land. Now, in his mind, he's doing it for the good of the other, for the greater good of his nation, race, whatever he wants to call his collective. And some of the other altruists in his own country at the time probably shared 9/10 of what he had to say. Like, yeah, we should give of ourselves, give for the greater good, live for our neighbor, share the wealth, all those things that were, you know, socialist workers party type values, right? And then the horror strikes. Wait a minute, I wasn't on for this. You know, what do you mean you killed 6 million people? That wasn't part of me. That wasn't part of my code. That wasn't me. Yes, it was. That was your code taken to its logical end. Because the logical end was for the greater good of, in this case, your race, your country, your nation, what have you, you must defeat the evil, defeat that which will take down the collective, right? That's what good and evil is about. Fighting off the bad for the sake of the good. So, too often, we have to say, well, then Hitler must have been crazy. Because, you know, I shared his moral code, says the average German in 1935 or what have you. I had his political values in mind. I was for my fellow man and, you know, I was willing to lay down my life for the good of the country. But then he went and did this thing with the Jews. I wasn't on for that. Well, hey, buddy, in for a penny, in for a pound. That's the moral code you signed up for, you know. No, he was crazy. All right.
You know, and then we over here who have lived in relative abundance for a very long time now, call it an interregnum, we grow up with a different, well, actually we grow up with somewhat of the same ethos, same ethic, although we don't have the mechanism to put it into place like Nazi Germany did. For breathing room, or to rid the world of what they consider to be subhuman. So we sit here in our comfy chairs and look over there and say, like, how do they come to that conclusion? I don't come to that conclusion. You know, killing people, innocent people, men, women, children. You know, I don't come to that conclusion. That's horrific. That's why we use the Holocaust as the exemplar of evil.
Right.
So now we have a new exemplar of evil, and that, of course, is October 7th in Israel when Hamas did something that will go down in history as, like I say, the exemplar, the example of what it is to be absolutely evil. And Douglas Murray, who's the author in Britain, nailed it, and we'll play a clip from him just in a minute. He nailed it when he was saying that the difference between Nazi Germany and the German soldiers, who, as you say, Paul, signed up for the fatherland, you know, to do something good for the fatherland and Christianity.
Well, there's a reason why it's an iron cross. It's not an iron circle.
Yeah.
They're awarding themselves.
Exactly.
They're holding up the cross as the ultimate good. So
was their highest badge of honor, was to wear the iron cross. Yeah.
Right.
So what happens when you get a Hamas terrorist growing up since infancy being told that this is your highest good is to destroy the Jews, to kill? And we hear, if you go online, my soul has been just basically shrunk over the last month listening and watching some of the atrocities that went on. But one thing struck me was this phone call that one terrorist made back to his parents, telling him that he just killed 10
Yes.
Israelis,
with his bare hands.
Some Jews, by his own hands. And he was calling them on the phone of the dead woman who he had just killed, asking, "Are you proud of me?" And the parents say yes. And the mother actually says, "Kill, kill, kill. It is chilling." Now, it's in Arabic, so I'm not going to play it here as a clip. But I will play Douglas Murray, the author, in conversation first with Piers Morgan of Sky News Australia, talking about the goings-on and some of the responsibility and who's responsible for the atrocities over there. He's actually standing with Gaza in the background. And while it's not on this recording, during the recording, which is a lengthy one, he actually had to duck for cover, him and his crew, because a missile from Gaza was fired near their direction. And thankfully, they shook it off because he's a veteran of war correspondence. And then following that, he had a sit down with John Anderson, again of Australia, where he recounts as a journalist sitting watching the film that the IDF put together to document the atrocities that were conducted by Hamas.
Well, I'm joined now by Douglas Murray, who's on the Gaza border. Douglas, what is your feeling about the motivation for this war from the Israeli side? Is it revenge? Is it something different? What are you picking up?
Well, it's not revenge. I mean, I think the most obvious thing is I spent part of today at the kibbutz of near Oz. This is a kibbutz right down the road from here by the Gaza border, where there are about 400 residents. 80 of them were kidnapped on the 7th of October, and another 30 to 40 were murdered. And I went through the remains of their houses, saw all the blood-spattered walls, and went through the charred remains of that village, that community. That was just one of the massacre sites. I went earlier past the massacre site of what you'll remember is there was a music festival, also near the Gaza border, which was taking place, where so many hundreds of young people were having a rave and then were massacred, raped, mutilated, and again kidnapped and taken through the border into Gaza. So you see the remnants of that appalling day everywhere around here. It's very hard to find a family anywhere in Israel that hasn't been directly or, you know, very closely related to the atrocities of that day. You know, 1,400 civilians slaughtered in one day and thousands more injured is the sort of thing that will have an effect on any society. It would be roughly comparative to, say, 20,000 people being killed in our own country.
Yesterday, I watched the raw footage about an hour. I think what I saw yesterday is, by some margin, worse than anything I've seen before. And I've been in Nigerian villages when a suicide bomber goes into the church on a Sunday and blows everyone up. And then people chase people through the fields, shooting them. I've seen enough exit wounds from children's bodies. But the footage of the 7th of October is a level of depravity that, yes, not even the Nazis did. Because the whole time they're massacring, throughout the whole thing, the Hamas fighters are in a state of utter elation. Utter elation.
Were the Nazis in a state of utter elation, you know, as they gassed the Jews?
Even the descriptions of the Einsatzgruppen, who were shooting Jews in the back of the head, in trenches, to fall into trenches, grave pits that they'd made the Jews dig for themselves. Even when you read the accounts, both from the very, very few survivors and from those who witnessed it and those who partook in it, say that the soldiers had to actually be weirdly enough protected from their acts by getting incredibly drunk in the evenings. Yeah. And being trying to forget what they'd been made to do. The Hamas terrorists are utterly elated and delighted by what they're doing. I said this yesterday, but I really don't want to hear Allahu Akbar shouted again on my streets. It's a war cry. The Hamas terrorists are shouting Allahu Akbar all the way through. all the way through, as they are using a shovel to decapitate a young man. With every blow of the shovel, they shout Allahu Akbar. When they go in to rape and murder all these young women in a room, they're shouting Allahu Akbar the whole time. When they find a young woman hiding under a table, pretending to be dead, and they realize she's alive, and they begin killing her, they're shouting Allahu Akbar all the time. And they're so elated. And they phone home. We've got the telephone calls now. They phone home. One disgusting young Hamas guy shouts from the phone of one of his victims, his father in Gaza, saying, I have killed with my own hands 10 Jews. Your son has killed 10 Jews. And the mother is put on the phone and they're all shouting Allahu Akbar and they're so proud of him. When the world sees hundreds of thousands of Muslims marching against Israeli actions in the Gaza, they either agree with what Hamas did and like it, and an awful lot do. We have an awful lot of predominantly Muslims in Australia, Britain, Europe, America, who like what I've just described. They're on board with it, and they'd like to do it to the 7 to 8 million Israelis. So people either like that and want it, or they're totally ignorant of this, or they think that in the wake of that, the Israelis should just simply sit back, take it. And I don't think...
Or if they must respond, it should be proportional.
Proportional would be a group of Israeli soldiers finding precisely the number of young women in the Gaza that the Palestinians found in the south of Israel, and raping precisely the same number of women, and then abducting them into Israel and spitting on their bodies and much more.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And what we just heard was horrific. Can you imagine what Douglas Murray and the journalists who were invited to see those films felt? I'm reminded, Paul, of the Jesuit maxim, give me the boy at seven and I'll give you the man. And we see on Twitter, if anybody's been paying attention, what we see are small children, usually boys, of course, in Gaza, in school, dressed in military fatigues, with toy weapons, pretending to behead Jews. And that is the equivalent of what here in Canada we may have as a Christmas play.
All right.
Or just a play. And this is what they're brought up to believe. I cannot fault any child for being indoctrinated into, or as some people say, brainwashed into this kind of a culture and philosophy. But once they become adults and act on their upbringing, of course, the blame falls squarely on their shoulders and that of their parents and teachers who preach this kind of hate. And when they bring it to the West, as Douglas Murray was saying, that day, a lot of them support this. And Pew Research did a survey worldwide a number of years ago now, and it would back that observation that a lot, the majority of Muslims in the West would agree with what is going on with Hamas. And that is so sad, and it means that we have a very large obstacle to overcome if we ever want to defeat this kind of thing. Now, Paul, I'll ask you, what is your opinion on what Douglas Murray was saying regarding proportionality as a reaction and blame? And this goes back to what Dave Rubin was saying, like, is this a mental illness? And I think it's clearly showing that it's not a mental illness when most of your population believe in it.
Right.
Right?
Well, you know, just to touch on that point. So I was saying before, you know, when you believe everybody around you and the guy you're arguing with is the same, has the same moral code as you do, and he hasn't got the same conclusions you have, you assume, oh, he doesn't have the facts. And then when that doesn't pan out, you say, oh, well, that he's crazy. Okay. But then all of a sudden you have a discussion and he explains to you that no, he doesn't believe have the same moral code as you. He has the one that says you're wrong, that your code is wrong. He's actually anti your code. So, for example, an objectivist versus an altruist, right? An Ayn Rand philosopher versus a I guess, a Kantian philosopher, let's say. Well, at that point, the teeth get bared. That's when the true anger comes out and the judgment does happen. Because if the person who says, thou shalt not judge because I don't want to end up getting judged myself, that person doesn't have to worry about it if what he's defending is the whole moral code itself. So you say, you're evil because you don't share my moral code. Now, think back. During what we just heard, there was a comparison between the Nazis killing Jews, shooting them in the back of the head at mass graves, versus the glee experienced by the attackers on October 7th. Well, if you remember what the Nazis thought of Jews, it wasn't that they had the wrong moral code. For Nazis, the problem with Jews was that they had all the wealth, or that they had all the influence, or that they weren't of the same race. Okay, but there was no questioning their moral code. And so a lot of the soldiers who didn't feel particularly good about murdering people probably didn't feel particularly good about murdering people because they still saw them as people sharing their moral code. That kind of hurts. Well, it should. But what about if you believe that the moral code of the enemy is not the same as yours? What if you believe not that Jews are of a different race or that they have all the money or they have all the power and the influence? What if you believe that their moral code is antithetical to all that is good and righteous and virtuous? What if they are the great Satan? You know, there's a reason why those words get used about the United States, because the United States has Western values, values of individualism, pride, productivity, capitalism. Those things are all antithetical to altruism. What did Jesus do that was so objectionable? He said to everybody, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Put your neighbor first. If you are a Muslim terrorist, you're saying that the Jews had a religion that needed to be changed by the introduction of these ideas by Jesus. Jesus, for them, a prophet, brought in these good ideas, these ideas of altruism. The Jews, they weren't altruists. They're everything that we are not. They're not altruists. They're egoists. Look at them with their wealth and their power and their influence. They think they're so great. They need to be taken down. They're Satan. In fact, in their own holy book, Jews in particular are singled out and called monkeys and pigs, like several times. I've read the Quran, so it's there. Pick it up. This deep-seated hatred for Judaism, from that perspective, I think, is not about race and power and etc., but rather about egoism. In other words, the belief, it's an incorrect belief, by the way, but the incorrect belief that Jews are opposed to altruism, and that therefore we should be very happy when we kill Jews because we're taking out Satan, we're taking out the enemy of the good. Of course they feel great, because that's what they're taking out the opposite of the good. You know, they're very happy at succeeding at taking out the opposite of the good. It's not necessarily what the Germans were doing. They're both doing evil things, but for different reasons. And I think that accounts for it. Now, if you're in North America, and you're not living by your own altruist moral code, and you want to say, look, you know, nobody's to be judged. Nobody's to be judged. Who am I to judge? I'm not going to judge the Palestinian. I'm not living there. Look at the horrible things he has to go through. You know, the moral equivalency. There is no judging. Oh, but wait a minute. You're saying that it's Jews in question? Well, then we can judge the Jews because they're not altruists like we are. They're not good people. We can take the side of the Palestinians because the Palestinians, ultimately, they're good-natured folks. They're good altruists who care about their neighbor and put others before themselves and all of that kind of thing. Whereas Jews, we believe to be, selfish, self-centered, don't care about anybody else but themselves, looking for profit, capitalists, look at all the wealth they've got, they own Hollywood, and all these, and the banks, and all these signs of power and influence that could only be achieved, they believe, by people who were looking after themselves, putting themselves first, living in an individualist, pro-life in a pro-life way, instead of in a self-sacrificial way. Everyone knows you're not going to become a billionaire by sacrificing of yourself constantly and with great integrity. You're going to be living a life of poverty and a life of doing without. And that's what they see as the good. The meek shall inherit the earth. The meek, not the bankers. Well, so I think that what accounts for North Americans being willing to demonize Israelis is a belief that you're not supposed to judge anyone except the enemy of altruism, and they wrongly believe that Jews are the enemies of altruism. I say wrongly because I've spoken, you know, with religious leaders in the Jewish community in Toronto, for example, and I was always astonished by how similar really it is to Catholicism, to any kind of Christianity. That do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Give for your neighbor. Be charitable. Be good. It's all through the Jewish community. You know, if you want to take down the guy you're envious of, the guy who's got it all, who seems to have it all, you've got to believe it's because he is the enemy of your moral code. He cheated at life. He stole from you. He's an oppressor.
This is a moral relativism argument that we see a lot here in Western society. It boils down to who am I to judge?
Yeah.
And it's very destructive, because if you do not understand that you as an individual have as much right to judge as anybody else, then you will be trampled on, you will be pushed aside, you'll be defeated and killed. I think it was Ayn Rand who says, judge, but be prepared to be judged. So don't give up that faculty in your mind which allows you to discriminate, and by discriminate I mean tell the difference between one thing and another, and to judge based on that discrimination. And that brings up another aspect, I think, of this philosophically. Now, we've talked about the moral aspect of something, but I think there may be an element of epistemology in this, and that is epistemology, of course, is the study of how we know what we know. And if we start to use one word, for example, the good, to describe things which are completely different from what you may think is the good, and this is what's going on over there, you know, this rape and pillage and murder and setting children alight is the good for some people, and for us it is not. There's also people, like you say, the people who say, who am I to judge what is the good, who would pick up an apple and say, well, that's tasty.
Yeah.
And then pick up a clump of dirt and say, well, that's tasty. And then pick up a sour fruit and say, well, that's tasty. In other words, everything's tasty to them. There's no discrimination. There's no distinction. There's no judgment.
Come on, you guys. You can come and see the baby now. Adam, Jerry and Elena here.
It's a cute little snuggly baby.
Isn't he gorgeous?
Gorgeous, yes.
So very gorgeous. Is it me, or was that the ugliest baby you have ever seen?
Oh, I couldn't look. It was like a Pekingese.
Well, this ointment should do it.
How are you feeling, Adam? Elaine, this is our pediatrician, Ben Pfeffer.
Hi.
Look at him, Elaine. How gorgeous is he? I ask you, how gorgeous?
Pretty gorgeous.
Elaine, do you have children?
Me? Oh, no, but I mean, I'd love to have a baby. I mean, I can't wait to have a baby. I'm just dying to have a baby.
A beautiful woman like you should. You're quite breathtaking.
Breathtaking? I'm breathtaking.
And he's very particular. Ben, you're staying over tonight, right?
Sure.
Oh, just look at him.
Yeah, he really is breathtaking.
Called me breathtaking before.
I've never been called breathtaking either.
I mean, if he thinks that baby is breathtaking, then who's not breathtaking?
Well, maybe he just said it because the mother was in the room.
Yeah, right, that's a possibility. I have to find out. Some night, huh?
Yeah. I wish I had my telescope.
Some dinner, huh?
Yeah. Nothing like really fresh-caught lobster.
Some house, huh?
It was built by Mark Farbman. He built a lot of these homes here.
Some ugly baby, huh?
What did you say?
I said, some snuggly baby.
He is something, huh?
Well, to tell you the truth, Dr. Pfeffer, I was surprised to hear you use a word like breathtaking to describe a baby. I mean, because you also used it referring to me.
Well, you know, Lan, sometimes you say a thing like that just to be nice.
George, thanks so much for making breakfast.
Georgie, these are the best scrambled eggs I've ever tasted.
I didn't know you could cook.
Well, I'm just expressing my gratitude to our gracious host.
Yes, George, the whole breakfast is breathtaking.
Well, wasn't that breathtaking to hear another episode of Seinfeld, Paul? I really loved that show.
Yeah, no, I, you know, it doesn't really touch on morality, that clip, but it really does focus you on this ambiguity. You know, here's Elaine thinking that, well, clearly by breathtaking, he means beautiful and he means me beautiful. And but then he used it against, you know, in respect to that baby. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute now. What did you mean about breathtaking? And turns out that he doesn't want to offend anyone. So he calls everyone breathtaking. He's neutral. He does not judge. And she finds.
And that is our society. That is our society right now. We don't judge.
Exactly right. Yeah. Also that we don't have to feel bad about ourselves. But why are we feeling bad about ourselves? Well, because we're trying to live by a moral code that's broken, that's designed to make you feel guilty, that's designed to make you feel bad, and to make you easily manipulable by making you feel guilty whenever someone says, how come you didn't take the shot so that grandma wouldn't get sick? How come you didn't stay locked up to keep us all from getting the... You know, all of this is altruism played out in real life. We saw that during COVID, where you're supposed to feel guilty about enjoying your own life, about pursuing your own values, about saying, is this medicine right for me? It's not about you. It's about all of us together as a collective. No, it's not. That's your altruism speaking. And your guilt and your condemnation of others is due to that altruism. And it's allowing this, it's festering in this moral relativism in which everything goes except one thing, altruism. If you attack our altruism, that's when you become the enemy. And if we think you're an enemy of our altruism, then all the gloves come off. We're going to side with any altruist we can find, even if he's carrying a flag of Hamas.
There's been a number of discussions in light of October 7th events that have made some people take notice of our culture. And what I fear they're not taking notice of is the morality rather than just the politics, because you have people out there, for example, the Jordan Petersons, the Ben Shapiros, and the Dave Rubens, those kinds of pundits out there talking about Western culture is worth defending. And what is Western culture? It is classical liberalism, the ideas of freedom of speech, of freedom of expression, you know, the usual rights that are ascribed in the Constitution of the United States. Those kinds of things, yes, they're political, they are Western culture, but I think that what we as a society in the West have to do is to go deeper than the politics, because politics comes from a sense of ethics and morality.
That's right.
And that's not what we're talking about.
Right. Well, that altruism is running contrary to all of those things that are Western values, right? So you can think of politics as like the tail of the dog. The dog wags the tail. The tail does not wag the dog. The dog is that ethical element, right? And if your altruist philosophy is telling you that the good is to not compete against your neighbor, to, you know, get wealthy, to think about what you value and pursue what you value instead of what he values, that's not capitalism. You're ultimately going to be looking for a collectivist system. In other words, socialism. If you want to have Western values defended, you have to defend the moral code upon which, you know, those political values are based. And that's not altruism, that's rational egoism. So what I mean by rational egoism, as opposed to maniacal egoism, where you just sort of chaotically say, me, 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 I'm taking what I want, I'm going to steal, rape, pillage, whatever. That is egoism, but it's not rational. It's not objective. It's subjective. It's nihilism. And that's a lot of what we're seeing on the streets today. But if it's rational, then it means that to decide what is of value to you, to your life, to your happiness, you use a reasoned approach. You look at the actual facts of reality, not the wishes and hopes and dreams, but the actual facts. You look in the mirror and say, okay, I have two eyes, and wishing's not going to make that not be the case. And then you apply a logical analysis of those facts to arrive at conclusions where your standard is your survival and the successful pursuit of your own happiness. And if you do that, you aren't going to be raping, pillaging, and taking your neighbor's stuff, because you know that in the long run, reason being engaged with the long run, or being paying attention to the long run, not to the expediency of the moment, you know that in the long run, being good is the good, is the thing that will give you happiness and success on this planet. And so what we ultimately need to do before we can even espouse, you know, rational egoism, is espouse reason. Don't get your ideas of what's true and false, right and wrong, from faith, wishes, whims, a show of hands, you know, the values of the community, national standards. None of that stuff matters. What matters is applying a logical standard to the facts of reality as you observe them with your own five senses. At the base of all of this, the reason that there are so many attacks on the facts of reality is because if the facts of reality are attacked, then reason's not going to work. So, for example, if I can say, well, you're not a man, you're whatever you want to declare yourself to be. You know, you can be a woman, you can be a zombie, you can be whatever you want, and we're going to respect that. Well, how then can anybody apply a logical standard to what the facts are when the facts are malleable? So this is a deliberate attempt, an attack on Western reason, attack on Western rational egoism, and an attack on freedom, to attack the facts of reality and say there are none, that it's all just what you whim, you know. So the rational standard is to say, I'm paying only attention to what my senses tell me, not according to what my neighbor tells me.
I think that Rand puts it best when she says the evil is the deliberate shutting off of thinking, the deliberate putting aside your consciousness. So when you see something that you don't understand, rather than trying to find out why that person is doing what they're doing, you prejudge, you misjudge, and or you, worst of all, you don't judge. And that is evil. That, Dave Rubin, may be the definition of evil. So I think if people join us here again on this show, then go back through our back catalog, I think you'll find that you can understand evil. You can define your terms. You know what good is. You know what bad is. You can find out what evil is, what morality is. And it may not, or it may be, what you think it is, but the onus is upon you, if you want to be good, to use your reason, to be rational, and to be sure to join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Okay, I've saved my favorite group for last. The Maniacs and Crazy People. Yeah. The ones who live out where the buses don't run. And I distinguish between maniacs and crazy people. A maniac will beat 9 people to death with a steel dildo. A crazy person will beat 9 people to death with a steel dildo, but he'll be wearing a Bugs Bunny suit at the time. So you can't put them all away. You know, you gotta keep some of them around just for the entertainment. Like a guy who tells you the King of Sweden is using his penis as a radio transmitter to send anti-Semitic lesbian meatloaf recipes to Soupy Sales and Marvin Hamlish. A guy like that, you want to give him his own radio show.